Good evening, I'm Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida. Welcome to Tuesday Topics. I'd like to thank our producer, Brian Charlson, for rounding up our guest for this evening. And I'd like to thank Steve Bauer for his recording of tonight's program, as well as for what I suspect will be an editing job that turns our chaos into a broadcastable hour-long ACB radio program that will appear on a future Tuesday some 2 to 3 weeks from now. Obviously, as well, I'd like to thank George Byes of Talking Communities, whose software makes this program possible. I do understand that the new version of Talking Communities software is actually being released as we speak, so those of you who were waiting around to see what the new system was going to look like should check out Talking Communities as soon as you are able to do that. Tonight on Tuesday Topics, we have a real treat. We have the opportunity to talk to someone who has been a pioneer in an interesting activity for folks who are blind. There are lots of us who have been, I suppose the correct word is, adopters of technology, and we've sort of struggled along in our own ways to try to make technology accessible to us. But there have been very few people who have actually taken the time and the trouble and the extra effort to put down on paper how technology works and to make those paper books pretty widely available for those of us who want to use them. Our guest, Anna Dresner, who's in Hawaii as we speak, and the temperature is probably warmer than it is in most parts of the country, is an individual who has now published 3 or perhaps 4 books on technology. We're going to talk to her about those books, about the prospects for technology, and about Anna herself. And I think if we could, I'd like to begin, Anna, by perhaps having you tell us a little bit about yourself and what got you started in the business of becoming the explainer of technology to us dunderheads out there.
Hi, I am Anna Dresner in Hilo, Hawaii, and it was never something that I really planned to have happen. Basically, I mean, I've been blind all my life, and I've certainly enjoyed trying new things when they were available. I jumped at the chance to haul around a Versa Braille with a cassette deck in high school to take notes with when I was fortunate enough to have the chance, and to play around with an Apple IIe and do a little bit of programming with that. But mostly, computers were kind of, you know, things I used when they were there and I got a chance. Several years ago, I worked for, I did some beta testing for Blazy Engineering and tech support for them. I worked at a rehab center in Kansas City teaching Braille and basic academics and whatnot. So I got some teaching experience that way. And then in, I guess it was 97, I got the chance to work for Brian Charlson at the Carroll Center and teach people computers for a couple of years, which was a very useful thing, both in terms of my learning computers and learning how it is to work with people. And then I was fortunate enough to get a job with National Braille Press, which was especially lucky because I was able to take that with me when my husband got a teaching job, first in Iowa and then here. So it's been great to be able to take that job with me as we've moved around. And in the process of that, I've done a lot of different things for National Braille Press, but the writing and editing of these tutorials and books on technology has been kind of a natural outgrowth of the work that I had already done and the fact that I enjoy writing. And it's kind of fun to play with technology, especially when someone else is buying it and you're playing with it on work time, and the results, you have a way of distributing without having to go do it yourself. So it's just worked out really well.
I don't know if I'm right in saying that the first book that that had Anna Dresner's name on it was the book concerning finding electronic books on the internet. If it was, why don't you tell us a little bit about that book and kind of what it includes?
Yeah, that was the first long thing that I did. And basically, it was an outgrowth of being asked to do a presentation at a conference in Iowa the last summer we were there about finding ebooks. I just happened to talk to somebody who was there, who was working with the blind community there, and asked me to come do this conference. And it seemed like a good idea for a book. There's actually been two editions of it because so much changed. But it's a book to try to help you tell people find out what's available and how to get it. So we start with the specialized services like the National Library Service and Web Braille, and the Canadian Library for the Blind, which name escapes me now, but and Bookshare and a couple other things. Then moving on to free ebooks like Project Gutenberg and the Online Books page. And then on to commercial sites like Bean Books, which actually releases all their electronic books as RTF files, so they're really easy to use. And FictionWise, which has a lot of their books in formats that are accessible and Audible. And then various sort of introduction to DAISY and what seemed likely to be the future of DAISY and so on. Of course, that section gets out of date fairly quickly, and then I had some appendices on things like what different formats are. If you see a file with BRF at the end, what does that mean? What can you do with it? And that include PDF and a lot of different file types. And also I put in some stuff about how to use Kurzweil and OpenBook and WBView to go out and do automated searches and downloads of books. So hopefully, a good starting place for people to learn about ebooks, and for people who already know something about it, hopefully to find some new sources.
Is it time for a third edition? Has enough changed to justify a new book, do you think?
I'm sure we will do one. Things do keep changing. Certainly we will when the digital downloads digital books, audio books from NLS become available. That will be a huge change. That might warrant it. In the meantime, for the book on blogging that I did, I had to create a blog, and one of the things its main function is to provide updated information. So I'm hoping that we can have fewer print editions if we tell people that they can go there and get information, and then I have to try to keep that up to date, and I'm sure things fall through the cracks, but my hope is to try to keep information up there that will keep the book relevant for longer.
As a kind of an observer of electronic books on the web, how are you feeling now about things like PDF books and Microsoft format books? Do you feel like we're making any progress in terms of creating more access to those two formats, which for the most part really aren't usable by us?
I have not looked at them for a while. I really haven't done anything with them for quite a long time. I mean, PDF documents in general I certainly look at, and I know, I really appreciate the fact that FictionWise, for one, is very clear about which of their books will work with screen readers, because if their books say the read aloud function is enabled, then you know that you can use it with your screen reader. I think that at least is a huge help when a site will let you know before you buy the book whether you're going to be able to use it. But I really haven't tried those formats in a while, so I'm not sure if things have improved or not.
Do you have any advice for us as somebody who perhaps has observed the scene about what we perhaps ought to do with folks who are producing inaccessible PDF books and who are producing encrypted formats as Microsoft does that are essentially not usable by us?
Well, at sites like FictionWise, we can vote with our feet and buy the formats, the versions, since a lot of times they'll put things out in multiple formats. We can download the ones that we know work, like the secured Palm documents. In terms of the other companies, I'm not really sure, other than to keep letting them know we're out here. certainly in situations where the books aren't available in other formats, I would think that there could be, would there be lawsuit abilities there? I mean, you hate to do that if you can get anything done in a more friendly way, but it certainly, it does seem like we just have to keep reminding them over and over that we're out here. It does get frustrating, doesn't it?
Yeah, it actually does, because there are so many books that are actually available electronically that we simply can't get hold of. What about the other sites in terms of audiobooks? And maybe I'm throwing questions at you that you're not jumping up and down over here. Audible.com is a site that's actually pretty accessible for us, and we can use it. But there are beginning to be some other places where audiobooks are available on the Internet. Are some of those actually pretty usable by us?
Well, again, I haven't really been looking. I'm so deluged at the moment by things to listen to and read that I really haven't felt the need to go searching. And since I haven't been working on the ebooks project for a while, I haven't really gone out actively seeking those. I certainly think it's great when they do come out. And of course, at least with audiobooks, you, other than the problem of whether you happen to have a player that will play the books, at least you don't have to worry about accessing the content. So that part is nice, as long as they can write a website that's navigable.
I guess that brings us to perhaps the next issue, which we can talk about for a minute and maybe just get some feedback from you. One of the things that I've noticed as kind of a person who dabbles in a range of technologies myself is the number of options that are out there now for playing materials that are downloadable from the Internet. And I think that's a blessing on the one hand, but on the other hand, it involves having to master an awful lot of different technologies, especially if you're going to learn to do them well. Do you think it is pretty tough for blind people to jump through that kind of hoop, or is it something that we just ought to be thankful for and shut up?
Well, I think it's certainly great to have choices. That's always a good thing, and so much better than the way it used to be when there really weren't very many. I do think it's frustrating that there are so many different players that you need. I mean, it's crazy. Right now, I have sitting on my desk a Bookport, an iPod Nano. I have an iPod Shuffle, but not so much because I'm using it now, but because I had it before. A MUVO player, and I'm in the NLS pilot, so I have their player sitting here. It is kind of crazy, and I do think especially, it's one thing if you kind of like gadgets, it's another if you don't, or if you, if you just want to read the books, it'd be nice. I hope eventually that people will get the digital rights management stuff figured out in such a way that you can buy one player that will play everything. I think that will make everybody's lives a lot simpler, and I imagine that will happen over time just because the general public, I think, has to be getting fed up with it as well. But I don't know. I mean, so at least that's good. It's not just a need that we have, but a need that everybody has. I don't think anybody wants to carry around 10 different players to play different things. Right now, anybody out there who wants to listen to, well, I guess you could play Audible. Well, if you want to listen to Format for Audible Books and you want to listen to OverDrive books that you download from your library, you cannot do it on one player. You have to have, well, maybe there are some out there that will play both. But and then if you want to play music from iTunes and you want to play music from from Walmart and music from Napster, you just can't do it all on one player. I don't think anyone's going to stand for that for too long. So I'm hoping that all of those things will also help to simplify this over time.
You're correct. I think the absence of of the ability to have one or two players that would handle a pretty large variety of formats is a real disadvantage. Well, you mentioned the magic word in your last transmission. You talked a little bit about using an iPod Nano, and that fascinated me a little bit because your book dealt with the iPod Shuffle. Since there are probably some of our listeners who don't have a lot of experience with these devices, why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about iPod and what iPod's all about, and then about the Shuffle, and then about the Nano, and about your book, and and how you've managed to move to a Nano and how well it works for you.
Well, an iPod, first of all, is a player made by Apple. Not just for computers anymore. It will play music files, MP3s, and their AAC format and their music that you buy from their music store. It will also play books from Audible and WAV files, so a fairly wide variety of formats. And there are lots of them, and there seem to be more varieties every time you turn around. The Shuffle was the first one that I ever saw, and I got one and wrote a book about it because it didn't have a screen. So you figure, the player doesn't have a screen, it ought to be usable by blind people. And so it seemed like a good place to break into this whole thing. And also, they are the cheapest model of iPod. So then that makes them the most accessible from that standpoint. So I guess it was about a year and a half ago that I got one, and then wrote a book about that whole experience with the process of buying it and installing iTunes, which is not accessible at all out of the box. Fortunately, after I wrote the book, then Brian Hartgen wrote scripts, which made it work really well in a lot of ways. I actually use iTunes to do most of the music management stuff that I want to do on my computer now. But also Anipod Explorer, which is another program that you can use to put content into an iPod, and it is definitely easier to use out of the box. Well, that went pretty well, and that book also has a how-to section at the end, so if you don't want to hear all the trials and tribulations, you can just skip to the end and find out how to do stuff. Of course, some of it's changed now because it has been a while, and the book was written and then the scripts were written later, but it's still got a lot of basic information. But then, the technology went on, and more people were finding ways to use the Nano, which does have a screen, is more complicated. The iPod Shuffle, basically, you just put everything in and play it. You can't group files into folders or anything. You hit forward and back, and then start playing from any point, or you can mix everything up to tell it to play in a random order. And that's pretty much it. Whereas on the Nano, you can have things arranged by artist or by album, or there's a lot more ways of arranging the music, of sorting things out. But and it also has a lot more memory, which is the reason. The Shuffle, at this point, I guess there's only... Well, the Shuffle came out originally in a half a gigabyte and gigabyte formats, which is really about as big as you want to get without any way of organizing it. So with the Nano, they do have menus and things which are pretty much necessary to organize all that music and books and whatnot, but then that brings in accessibility challenges. But it seemed like it was about time to... this summer to see how things would go with the iPods and with the Nano and how it would be to access that. So National Braille Press agreed that I should explore writing a book on the Nano. So I got a Nano and found out that with it will click as you move through menu items, and it stops at the top and bottom. So you get to the bottom of the menu, you can't go any farther. Or at the top. So it is possible to figure out where you are, but you do have to count clicks, which is kind of a pain. Then I also found out about Rockbox, which is open source software that you can install on an iPod and various other players, which allows them to talk. And you can also run a program that will make all of the files and folders file and folder names speak as well. And so I did that and learned how to do that stuff, and sure enough, I have a player that now I can, move through and pick an artist and pick an album and pick a song, and it all talks. You can even do things like speed up and slow down files, which is great for listening to a podcast, skimming through things, or if you're doing something like, I was playing some music, I was trying to learn a song, I needed to play along with what I was listening to and being able to change the speed so that the pitch matched my guitar. That was really cool. The only thing about that, however, is that you can't play any protected content like Audible books when you're running Rockbox. So suddenly now, on this one little player, you have to run two different operating systems, basically. You have to run Rockbox for your unprotected stuff, and you have to run the Apple firmware that came with it for your protected stuff. So it's still kind of complicated, but at least it is usable. And until about a month ago, you could just go out into the store, buy this thing, install Rockbox, and have a talking player. And I thought, great, I'm all set. I'm going to write this book. It's going to be great. And then Apple came out with their new versions, which are different enough that the Rockbox crew has said it's going to take them a while to get Rockbox to work on it. So now I'm sort of waiting to see how long that takes, because it's obviously a lot more exciting to write a book about something that people can go out and buy new in the stores without any question than something they have to go find on eBay. So we're going to wait and see, but it's really cool what Rockbox is doing, again, with the iPod and a lot of other players, and it's really neat what, that these things are possible, and I've been having a blast listening to Audible books and songs and all sorts of stuff on my iPod.
Can you give us an idea of what the price of an iPod Nano is these days, and also how much Rockbox runs one? And I assume it's software that you have to download to the iPod Nano from your computer?
Right. Rockbox, basically, you have to install a bootloader on your iPod. That's the trickiest part, that you've got to type in a bunch of commands from a DOS prompt, which then enables the player to either boot up to the original Apple firmware or to the Rockbox firmware. And once you do that, installing a new build of Rockbox is just unzipping files into a directory. So that's pretty easy. And also putting a voice file in the right place so that it can talk. And that is free, which is just amazing when you think about what it does and the fact that this whole thing is being done by volunteers. It's a remarkable project. The iPods, in terms of the price at this point, it's kind of hard because, again, the most recent ones are now, do not work with Rockbox. I want to say the new ones have 2, 4, and 8 gigabyte sizes. I believe that the 2 is now like 150, and the 4 is 200, and the 8 is 250, but I could be wrong on that. But I think that's about where they are.
Excellent. I think I was one of the early adopters of your book when it came out. I bought it from National Braille Press. One of the nice things about National Braille Press, for those of you who don't know, and by the way, their website is www.nbp.org, is that all of the books that are available from National Braille Press can either be ordered in Braille or can be paid for and downloaded directly from their website. So you can this very evening go and get some Anna Dresner books without waiting for the postman to deliver a Braille copy for you. When I downloaded your book and read it, I was also immediately encouraged to rush out and buy the scripts, and I agree, they certainly make iTunes more usable. And I think iTunes is a pretty powerful system, works reasonably well on the PC if you have scripts that work with it most of the time. I appear to have an unfixable malady with mine. So my iTunes is currently kind of dead and paralyzed. So I'm hoping that I'll be able to find some time to resurrect it, because I really haven't devoted the time I should have to try to get it up and running again. But I think the iPod Nano issue is certainly a good one, and I think that Rockbox sounds like a pretty cool idea. I don't know a lot about the project, and I suspect that there are others who don't as well. Could you tell us a little about how the Rockbox project came about?
I'm not an expert on Rockbox either, but I believe it was started by people who wanted to add functionality to some players. I think the Archos, I guess, I've never been quite sure, players were the first that Rockbox supported, and then several of the iRiver players. It was not primarily designed for blind access. I mean, that was not the purpose of it, per se. The purpose was to give you, to give people the ability to play formats that they couldn't have played on the players to begin with. Also, it's kind of funny now, iTunes 7, they've made a big deal about that they've got gapless playback, so that when you have two songs on a live album, you don't hear a little break in between them. Well, Rockbox has been doing that for a long time. Also, when you read their manual, some of the sound setting stuff, it's clear, was designed for genuine audio files. There's a setting that is supposed to mimic the effect of listening over speakers on headphones, so that some of the sound from one speaker goes into the other ear and vice versa, to give you a less differentiated sound to make it more enjoyable to listen to. That's a fairly subtle feature that, most players wouldn't have. And so I think, there were just people who wanted to see that kind of thing available. I could be wrong, but I think that was kind of how it got started, and then they've been trying to put on more and more players. But if anybody knows more about the origins of Rockbox, it'd be great to hear from you later on in the show.
And the voice was added by the Rockbox people themselves, kind of in recognition of the needs of blind folks, or just because they thought it was a cool thing?
I'm not exactly sure why it was added, but I mean, obviously now that it's there and more and more blind people are interested in it, they have made a real effort to consider the needs of blind people in the product. Just an example of that, a couple months ago, the default behavior until a couple months ago was that when you had the player on, the first time you hit a button, it would turn the backlight on, and then the next button press would actually do something, and this was being confusing to a lot of blind users. So after some discussion on the Rockbox mailing list, they decided that they would make more sense to have the default behavior. It was always possible to turn that off, I should say, because almost everything they do you can turn off or not if you want. It's very customizable. But they decided to make the default behavior such that if you press a key, it activates that key. And then if somebody wants the first key press to turn on the light, that they can change that setting themselves, since it would be easier for a sighted person to make that change than for the blind person to deal with the fact that their first key press wouldn't do anything. So it's been neat to see them willing to take something which, I don't think they put the voice on specifically for blind people, but then once they realized that that was something of interest, just to really take that and work with it and try to make it work well.
That brings us to the latest project that I know about, which is your book on this word that sounds almost like an expletive, blogging. Some of our folks will have no idea what blogging is, so perhaps you would begin by telling us what it is, and then telling us why it is that you wrote the book and a little more about the whole subject.
A blog is short for weblog. I'm not quite sure how that happened. Usually things get shortened from the beginning, and this one, I guess because from the beginning you get weblog, which doesn't really work very well. But sort of a journal or a place for people to write down their thoughts online to begin with, but it's gone a lot of different ways. Basically, what it is a web page set up that you don't have to know how to start a web page. You fill in like a title for your post and what you want to say, and it puts it up there and arranges it in a reasonable fashion. And they're used in all sorts of different ways. There are the personal ones where, you know, you say, on this day we did this. We have one for sharing family pictures so that, you know, friends and family who don't live here can find out what we're up to. There are ones on history and science and politics and all sorts of things where people will write about current events and give their impressions or historical background or scientific background or whatever it is. There are blogs devoted to all different crafts. It's just, it's a huge amount of stuff, some of it very informal and some of it very academic or, you know, pretty serious in terms of the subject matter. My husband had been blogging for quite a while, so at least I knew about it, but I also knew I didn't have a lot of time for that sort of thing. But last winter, Diane Croft, my boss, said, "Hey, why don't you write a blog book?" So I said, "Okay." And in a way, that was a good way to go into it, because I went into it not knowing all that much. You know, from my husband, I had some idea of the power of them and what they could be good for, but, you know, not knowing anything about the mechanics of it all. And so then I started a blog, which is the NBP Updates blog, which is at nbpupdates.wordpress.com. And it's a place to write up new information about my books. I needed a topic that would be, something that would be useful. It's something that I could, you know, see the point of spending the time on, and hopefully, you know, hopefully be useful to people. And so then, I wrote the book. Then, you know, when I'm writing about how to create a blog, it's kind of out of the experience of having just done it. So basically what the book is, it starts off with kind of defining a blog and walking you through reading a blog. Of course, now the second blog that I walk people through, the first one was my own. It's a pretty simple one, a good place to start. The second one I walked everyone through was the Mosin Explosion blog. So now you will find on my site a list of a couple of other blogs that fill some of the functions of his, because a month or so ago he pulled it all off the internet. And then there's a section on how to find blogs that you might be interested in, either through various search engines or through what are called carnivals and roundups, where people go through and select the best posts on a certain topic. Like you might have a science one where people would have, you know, some of the best posts on science or whatever. And then there's a section on how you keep up with it. All these different blogs that you might be interested in, you don't really want to have to go to 20 different web pages to read about them. So using a technology called RSS to keep up with them, where you can go to one place and see all the latest posts from all of the blogs that you're interested in. And then there's a section on how to create a blog. There are a couple of services that I tried out and give you directions for, most of which still is pretty relevant. Then at the very back, I have a list of HTML commands, because you don't need to know a lot of HTML, but most of the blog creation services use editors that get in the way of access. It can be hard to find the text where you're supposed to be writing if you move off it and come back later or something. So it's hard to use their built-in editors. And so you can make up for that by writing your own basic HTML for how to do a paragraph or how to do a list or things like that. And then there are also a few keystrokes for web navigation, for moving by lists and headings and things, which you might not have run across, you know, people might not have run across in their regular surfing, but are really useful for getting around blogs. So hopefully it's enough to get people started.
For the most part, is blogging a pretty accessible occupation? You know, we are dealing with text here, so is text typically in most blogs pretty readable with screen readers?
For the most part, a lot of blogs really do use fairly straightforward templates. Some even use headings really well, and that's very cool, because the person writing the blog doesn't even have to do that. But like on mine, all the posts have a heading at the beginning, so that you know, it makes it pretty easy to move from one to the next. Not all templates do that. And some services are easier to use than others. You know, I've had good luck reading blogs from Blogger and blogs from WordPress. I've heard that some of the, what is it, RSpace, that some of those kind of places aren't as usable. I haven't really had the need to go there. You know, LiveJournal I've used. You know, it'll depend to some degree on who is actually hosting the software, who's running the blogging software that you're using, as to how accessible it will be. But certainly, WordPress, Blogger, LiveJournal, all of those blogs are really pretty easy to read.
Is there any mixing and matching going where you've got people writing blogs and at the same time getting involved with kind of mixing podcasts into the mix?
Yeah, that's pretty common. I've certainly seen Jeff Bishop had, for a while, had a podcast going along with his blog. Brian Hartchen has occasionally put up an MP3 on his website and then linked to it on the blog, which, if you do that, it can basically make it a podcast. It's using the same RSS technology is used to deliver blog posts to your reader, to your blog reader, or podcasts to your podcatching software, to the software that you might have to go get podcasts. So yeah, and there's certainly a lot of overlap in people doing maybe brief audio posts on an otherwise text blog.
Can you download blogs to devices like the Bookport or a Notetaker pretty easily?
Yeah, you can certainly read it's a web page, so you can read it on a Notetaker, or you could use the Send to Bookport page. The only thing you might not get comments depending on how they're set up, because sometimes you have to. That's one aspect I forgot to mention, is not only a person writing on a blog, but then depending on how the blog is set up, people might be able to comment on the article, so that you can have a conversation going on. And some blogs are very active in that respect. So depending on how it's set up, sometimes you'd have to click through to another page to see the comments. So that could be a little harder on the Bookport, although I guess with the Bookport Spider thing, you might be able to pull that off as well. And certainly you could on a note taker. I mean, if it's assuming it's the kind of blog that is straightforward enough to read with your PC, you should be able to read it with a note taker as well.
Well, we know that you're thinking about writing a new book on the Nano. Are there any other projects that you have up your sleeve that you'd like to tell us about before we open it up for questions and feedback from our listeners?
Well, I'm kind of... let's see, right now I'm actually in the middle of producing a Braille version of Jonathan Mosen's Google tutorial. It was an excellent tutorial. I think it's got, there's a lot of reasons that a wide audience would be interested, and Diane and I both felt that having it in a Braille form would be good for people who either are deafblind or prefer to learn things by reading instead of listening. And now, since Jonathan's no longer selling the recorded version, it's nice that it'll still be out there and available to people. And after that, we're kind of, we'll see if the Nano book comes to fruition. I mean, I'm sure it will. It's just a question of when. We have some other possibilities. One thing you'll be seeing, it's not really a technical book, but you'll be seeing in a couple months, I went through, with the help of Amy Rule, who also works at National Braille Press, through these three books for young people on first job, first apartment, and first bank account, or managing bank accounts and credit cards. And they were excellent books designed for teenagers and, people in their early 20s or whatever, and went through and added blindness-specific information to those, which was a lot of fun, and it was definitely nice to do something non-technical for a while, but still hopefully useful to a lot of people.
I think the time has come to open it up and see if folks have some specific questions on any of the work that you've done or in any of the directions that we may be going. So let's see who will be our first person. Remember to tell us who you are and where you're from.
Hello, this is Gary Wood, and from Lansing, Michigan. Yeah, blogs sound like the thing to do now. I guess you can also these MP3s, like the podcast, you can burn those to CDs and also play them on your MP3 player, CD player.
It's amazing what you can find, the variety, everything from stuff from National Public Radio and other professional outlets to amateurs on any topic you can imagine. It's pretty exciting.
Maybe it might not be a bad idea for you to provide us with kind of a definition of a podcast as well.
Basically, a podcast is an MP3 file. Well, they're not all MP3, but the vast majority of them are, that are done as sort of a radio show type format. And usually they're released on a certain schedule, like someone might do one every day or every week or whatever. And then they're set up in such a way that you can have a program, people call them podcatchers a lot of times, that will see if there are any new episodes, and if there are, download them. You can make that as automatic as you want. You can have it set up so that every time you turn on your computer, it goes and get this program goes and gets whatever's new, or do that however you would like. The beauty of that is that it's pretty easy to load it up into whatever you want to listen to it on. You do not have to listen to it on an iPod. People just started calling it that, I guess, because iPod was the most common player that people were listening to them on. But since most of them are MP3s, you can listen to them on just about anything. For instance, on Main Menu and some of the other ACB radio shows are available as podcasts, and so you can download them and listen to them whenever you like instead of having to listen to them on a schedule.
Brian Charlson here from the Boston area. I'm delighted to have Anna back working for me a little bit on a couple of writing online tutorial projects. I'm interested in the writing process. Now, with the blogging book, you're able to update it because you're using the blog to update things, but I'm sure that's not been the case for the vast majority of NBP books over time. I still have on a bookshelf in my office the initial technology-related books that NBP put out. And then there was a while later, some time later, when there was kind of a fire sale on all the pressed copies they had of those, even then, out-of-date books that people could get. In fact, I think I saw online not too long ago Amy posting some of those for free for the asking kind of things. How do you go through the process of writing something that tends not to date itself, even in the field of technology?
Well, it's very difficult to do. I mean, well, it's pretty much impossible. I mean, one thing you can do, of course, is be clear about what's true as of the time you're writing and what isn't. You know, I try not to say, you know, what you need to have to, you know, what the browser you need is Internet Explorer 6 is the latest version. I try to say, you know, as of this writing or whatever, so that, you know, it will remind people that they may need to check and see if the information has changed. So that's one thing. And then there's some stuff like the web navigation aspects where, you know, at least that will be of some help to people for a while. The other book that I did a little while back was Braille.com and Beyond, which is about our website, the National Braille Press website. And one of the reasons we did that was shameless self-promotion. But the other reason was to, you know, because we would know that that site would stay pretty much the same for a while. And so there was a little more stability than when you try to use just any old site and then hope that things will at least change slowly enough that what you've done is relevant for a while.
I guess another issue for me anyway is trying to choose a target in a field that's moving as quickly as it is now. I know that one of the developments that's occurred over the past year or two is the immense growth in the use of Skype and in the increase of functionality that exists with Skype as well, and a number of programs that have begun to emerge that are kind of add-ons to Skype as well. And I'm wondering if NBP or you are giving any thought to perhaps doing a book on Skype and some of the many things that you can now do with it.
Well, it's an interesting idea. Jonathan Mosen did an excellent Skype tutorial in April, and I got to say, it's so much fun to listen to someone else's tutorial and let them tell me which settings are the best based on their painful experience, rather than having to be my own. I thought that was just fantastic. So I'm not sure we'll be doing that soon. I don't think there's quite the need for doing it in Braille that there would be with Google, just because the interest isn't quite as broad, and it being a telephone program primarily, maybe it wouldn't be as useful to some people. But it's always worth considering. Certainly it's hard to figure out sometimes what's the best thing. And you're right with the some of these chat programs and whatnot. But then there's so many different chat programs and so many different, phone programs and messenger programs. It is kind of hard to know which one is going to have the most interest.
I don't know how closely in touch you're keeping with things like education, but one of the other things that I've been wondering about, we are in the process of switching at the college where I work from a program called WebCT to a new program for handling much of the virtual college or distance learning that is going to happen through our college. We've been pretty careful to try to assure that what we're going to change to is going to be at least as accessible as the WebCT that we're currently using. But there are an awful lot of blind people who've said to me that they won't tackle distance learning because it's just too hard. So that might be another area that if there's enough standardization or enough stuff that you can say that are generalizations that might make a good book down the road.
That is a really interesting idea. I haven't really been following the distance learning stuff myself, but obviously, it should be a natural fit if it's the least bit accessible for a lot of people who, are trying to take courses, especially since you can take them from home if you need to, or in and around a job or whatever. There's certainly a lot of good reasons for exploring that kind of thing. And I will keep all of these in mind. And I know some of the ones earlier, I'm not dismissing them out of hand. It's certainly, all of them are really good ideas that are really worth considering. And I certainly think this one in particular is one I haven't seen anything really, done about it, and is going to be, more and more useful.
Well, I'm going to throw in a couple of petty thoughts here. I, too, think that Skype would be a good idea, but probably it would be better to do a book on internet telephony in general and do a component on Skype and a component on two other similar type of products so that people can actually pick and choose a little bit rather than being stuck doing the one thing that has grown a little bit in the blindness community. Something I'm really interested in learning more about in terms of its accessibility is what they call online social networks like MySpace and Facebook. Those kinds of, I guess they're just called online communities or social networks on the net, and how we can more effectively participate in them. Many of them are quite text-oriented as opposed to audio-oriented.
Certainly, it's good stuff to consider because obviously it's good to work on things that allow people to be in closer touch with each other and find new people and all that sort of thing. Certainly, we'll certainly consider it.
So I guess I'm going to ask you the obvious question. If you were to look in your crystal ball, what do you see down the road in the future? Obviously, we're approaching the point at which NLS is going to transition to digital books, and we're not quite sure exactly how all of that will play out. But what other things do you see on the horizon that we blind people who are prepared to be technical risk takers or technological risk takers might look forward to?
Well, gee, my crystal ball has got a lot of cracks in it, so I'm not sure. don't hold me to anything. I hope that that in general, as people want simplicity and want to be able to use the books they buy, you know, sighted people and just people in general, that will simplify some of the DRM kinds of stuff, the digital rights management stuff that says you can play this file in this way on this machine, that hopefully that sort of thing will simplify over time. I would hope that maybe some of the navigation built into DAISY would carry over into mainstream books. I know that the DAISY Consortium has tried to do that and that there's been some interest in that. I certainly hope that that can happen. How copyright gets handled is going to have a pretty big impact on all of it. And so it's kind of hard to tell where that'll end up. But, I mean, the potential is just staggering. There's really no reason that most books that are published, since you know that most of them were probably produced in electronic form to begin with, you know, there's no reason why they shouldn't be, why we shouldn't be able to read them when they first come out. I certainly would think that the quality and quantity of books that we have access to should keep going up.
What about the crossroads, if you like, between the internet and the cellular telephone? Do you think, you know, there certainly was a time, I think, when many of us thought that when that actually happened, people would opt for a simple interface, people would opt for using more speech, and to a degree that happened. But I don't think nearly to the extent that we'd hoped it would. Do you still see the kind of intersection of the cell phone and the internet to be a place that we can be hopeful, or have we passed the point of no return, and is it really not going to help us much?
Well, we have, what, two different screen readers for cell phones now? That's pretty significant. And certainly, as these different devices, you know, the PDAs and the cell phones and the MP3 players and all those things start kind of blending into each other, you know, maybe we'll be able to get ones that have those features.
I mean, there are other much more serious issues. I think it would be absolutely wonderful to if a blind person were to be able to take a picture of somebody who is potentially molesting him or her, and store that picture and send it out and make it do something. I think there's some real potential for feeling far safer if one has access to a digital image maker that can send it somewhere else. I think there are huge numbers of uses for it. You know, we'll probably get to places where we'll be using cell phones with Go to My PC or some sort of program like that, where we could actually perhaps even take a picture of a page of a menu, and then have our computer in effect scan that page and send the information back to us on our cell phone. I don't think that's far-fetched. It wouldn't surprise me to see that sort of technology available to us in 2 or 3 years. We already have, you know, one of the first blindness-only add-ons beyond speech for cell phones are color identifiers, which is a pretty cool idea.
The NFB reader, you know, having the camera and the PDA and the scanner all built into each other. You know, I'm sure, you know, as the cameras get better and smaller and the PDAs get more powerful, you know, we're going to see more of that, where you can have, you know, with you a machine that can read to you that, will just get better and smaller too.
Last questions or comments for Anna?
Well, Anna, one of the things, since so much of what you've written about has been your own discovery of how to use something like the iPod and like blogging, among other things, I'm curious, are we ever going to get to see you write something up about raising a child as a blind mother of a sighted child? Max sounds like he's turning out to be quite the young man.
Well, that would be an interesting one. This is always the privacy thing of, you know, how much do you really want your the inner workings of your, you know, everything to be out there in the public eye and all of that. Who knows? It's always possible.
I think that the whole issue of privacy is becoming more and more an issue with the internet. I don't think our society has come close to beginning to even begin to look at some of the issues surrounding the fact that there are coming to be cameras every quarter mile within most large cities. GPS technology can actually now locate you with your cell phone in case of an emergency if it's needed. And there are so many ways in which it is probably accurate to say we have very little privacy left. Almost anyone can get onto most of our computers and look at what's there. Clearly my bosses can, anytime they want to, look at exactly what's on my computer at work. And you know, the degree to which there is even electronic space that's truly ours is becoming a real issue. And I think one of the things that we're going to come to in the future is a time at which those of us who value our privacy are going to ask when this is going to stop and how we are going to protect ourselves from invasions, from the electronic world that are simply unwanted and inappropriate.
Yeah, and it's tricky because there are people who seem to enjoy putting every single thing that they might possibly be thinking about up. And then, there are people who would like to have some space of their own. And so figuring all of that out can be a little tricky.
Anna, thank you very much for being with us tonight. I think you have managed in a relatively short period of time to give our listeners an opportunity to get a snapshot of some of the changes that have happened over the last 4 or 5 years. I think you yourself have played an immensely important role in making those changes accessible to folks who are blind and who don't have the sense of adventure that gets so many of us who are here into trouble most of the time. I'd like to thank you very much for being with us, and I'd like to thank all who participated this evening in our program and all of our listeners for being a part of tonight's Tuesday Topics. Next week on Tuesday Topics, we'll have the opportunity to talk with Dean Stenchum, who is superintendent of the Washington School for the Blind. We'll talk about the role that schools for the blind are playing in 2006. We'll also talk about new roles that might be emerging for schools for the blind and some of the innovative new directions that the Washington School for the Blind is taking. Please join us for what we believe will be an exciting and informative program on Tuesday Topics on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday, 1 hour Universal Time. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. The first time you enter the chat room, the software will automatically download and install on your computer. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each show begins, those online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room service and how it works. An announcement promoting the topic to be discussed will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends list early each week. So we hope you will come and join us Tuesday each week when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. Again, the URL is ourplace.acbradio.org.